Harpo the Healer. Welcome to the Harping with Harpo series.
This is pod 39.
These pods are a supplement to Harpo the Healer on YouTube. Don't forget to have a look at all other episodes. You'll note some are loosely based around blues and blues harmonica. However, we're not rooted and explore many interesting avenues, covering some famous unsolved mysteries and in-depth analysis, while if not on a musical area of interest, cover some great feats of human endeavour and dig into the human condition.
Today I'm a solo talking head and I'm looking at Mount Everest, the highest mountain in the world. The height in itself being a fascination, its beauty is a spectacle, and I'm going to delve into the people that choose to climb it, study it, perhaps, or simply go and see it, all of which in part, I guess, are ticking off their bucket list. The prestige that often comes with this, either going there or doing the climb. And if you feel that the podcast is beneficial in any way, Harpo the Healer YouTube page has got a link on there to donate to channel to support it and drive us forward. The podcast was made on the 3rd of February 2024. In Southeast Asia, lying on the border between Nepal and the Tibet autonomous region of China, the Mahalanga subrange, the Himalayas, is Mount Everest, planet Earth's highest mountain above sea level. Its actual height, its elevation, is 29,032 feet, or 8,849 metres. Now, I've done a lot of research on this when I looked at multiple sources, credible sources, and, you know, some say 29,035, some are at 31, 32, 3, 4, 5. So I've gone for 29,032 feet. So that's the ballpark. So is there a reason? Well, you may well ask. The answer is because the mountain is changing. Scientists say Everest is getting taller over time because of the plate tectonics. As the Indian plate slips under the Eurasian plate, it uplifts the Himalayas. But by the same token, earthquakes can reduce their height in an instant. For example, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake in 2015 that killed thousands, including climbers on Everest, scientists suspect that the mountain actually got shorter. So there's an ever-changing fluctuation within a few feet of the of Everest. And so every few years, I think they did one the year after COVID, the Chinese will send a survey team up and they send it to take some measurements using GPS receivers, etc. And then I think then Nepal would do the same. And then they analyse their findings and then publish their data. And so that's every so often that's what they do. Just throw that out there. Just knowing the height of the thing can alert my senses, simply because I know that many people have climbed Everest. A few have reached the summit, however, a lot don't make it. Many have died in the process on the mountain, and bodies have even been lost and left up there, somewhere frozen in time. As you can imagine, to the indigenous people, whose families go way back from the area, have had huge respect and admiration for the mountain. Most noteworthy, the Tibetan name Chumalungma, which translates as Goddess Mother of the World or Goddess of the Valley. And Sanskrit, which is the sacred language of Hinduism, classical Hindu philosophy and of historical texts, and Buddhism and Jainism, name it Sagarmatha, translated means Peak of Heaven. Amazingly enough, it wasn't recognized as the highest peak until 1852. The Governmental Survey of India secured that fact. So by 1865, the mountain used to be known in these circles as Peak number 15. Peak 15 was renamed for Sir George Everest, British Survey General of India. He was there from 1830 to 43. It's strange sometimes how things get their names. Well, I could continue and fester over that for years, couldn't you? Thinking about if that was right or wrong. But anyway, nevertheless, that's how it came about, that piece of trivia. But I guess it wouldn't be productive to dwell on it too much. I'll venture onward and upwards, as the saying goes. I won't dwell on this next bit either, but suffice this to say that the Himalaya ranges were squeezed and driven upward, if you like, Teutonic plates. The Indian and Australian plates went to the north and was subducted, which by that I mean slid beneath, resulting two plates colliding, and this happened 40 or 50 million years ago. Everything driven upwards to and from the Himalayas of today. 225 million years ago, India was a large island situated off the Australian coast and separated by the Tethys Ocean. Everest, together with other peaks in the area, are all part of a large mountain range. Everest itself is made up of a layer upon layers of folded rock, sort of folded back on themselves. On much lower levels, they are the metamorphic rocks that have basically changed from their original ignorance, basically the rocks subjected to huge heat and pressure and rich fluids and high mineral content and mixture and a combination of all these facts. And some way up are found the sedimentary rocks of marine origin, that's the salt water which existed at the end of the Paleozoic era, what they call the Thetis Sea. This is basically an ancient floor, the Thetis Sea, closed after the two plates collided. What's very interesting is the Yellow Band, a limestone formation which can easily be observed just below the summit pyramid. This desolate northeast, southeast and west ridge all come together in Everest Peak, the summit. So the question today is, why do people want to climb Mount Everest? Why do some people choose to go there, get as close as they can? Others pick various challenging climbing routes. However, whether a seasoned hiker or professional rock climber, whatever route is chosen, the dangers are many and the mountain is unpredictable and unforgiving. Irrespective of the routes taken and the challenges, the one thing that springs to my mind is simply the height, just over 29,032 feet. Now, think of aviation, flying, for example. Once you're 10,000 feet up and above, because for any length of time to function well, you need oxygen. For example, the mandatory rule in general aviation, or it used to be, I haven't checked recently, but should be using supplementary oxygen after exceeding 30 minutes above a cabin altitude pressure of 12,500 feet. And that's MSL, which stands for mean sea level. As we all know, we inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. With each normal breath, you inhale about 0.5 litre of air, 20% of which is oxygen. So at 18,000 MSL, that's what I said was mean sea level, you have half the sea level air pressure, so half the oxygen. The experts tell us that oxygen starvation first affects the brain, and so judgment is impaired. So it's possible you may not know what is actually going on and you might have a serious problem on your hands. Everyone reacts differently to the effects of hypoxia. Only physiological training can be and safely administered by experts. You can find out, for want of a better word, your tolerance level. But of course, even the individual can change depending. For the cream of the aviators, the fighter pilots, this type of training is mandatory. That puts them right in the ballpark every single day of their working lives. For the fighter pilot, they learn to recognise the symptoms of hypoxia, which can be a lifesaver. Now, I've no idea about the people who choose to tackle Everest, but I would have thought, or you would have thought, that that kind of training should be mandatory for anybody going up Everest. Whether that is or not, I don't know. Now, breathing, essential part of a human being's existence, is being messed about with on Mount Everest. This breathtaking mountain, forgive the pun, holds some terrible tragedies for mankind. Within its folds, every year, the tragedies keep getting bigger and bigger. Around 600 people visit Mount Everest every year with the intention of reaching its peak. And on average, 5 people a year die in the attempt. That seems a heck of a lot to me. This last source I'm looking at, Himalayan database, quoting for here that at least 322 people have perished on Mount Everest since records began in 1922. Now that's what it says. So, no doubt there'll have been more before, I'm sure. The data, and it says that on average 4.4 deaths a year. That's throughout the whole time. The summit was first reached on the mountain in 1953, but you know, I'll come back to that because I always think that depends how that is viewed. I mentioned that there was an average of 4 to 5 a year deaths, yet look at the year for 2023, for example. 17 climbers died to and from the summit. Although vast experience surely is the key to survival, well, that doesn't always follow on Everest. In 2001, Babu Chris, a Sherpa, died from a fall near the camp. He'd climbed the mountain 10 times and spent 20 hours on the summit of Everest in 1999. It was a new record. From what we've looked at so far, 2023 was way, way above the average for deaths. Which seems odd, with knowledge, technical advances and equipment and training and all the rest of it. As I said before, the mountain is unforgiving. So, why is all this happening? Well, first let's look at the approach to Everest. There are, as near as damn it, two major routes to reach the peak. The first one comes from the north direction, from Tibet, while the other one is used more widely and comes from the southeast, in Nepal. It was 1953. Was the first successful ascent of the summit by Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. They decided to use the southeast ridge route to reach the peak. Now, of course, I surmise that it may have been done long before this by some of the indigenous people of the area and the Sherpas and everything. But of course, it's never been verified, has it? So, you know, Hillary and the fantastic attempt with Norgay that they did was recognised and recorded, so of course they officially get it. But of course it's the oxygen aspect, isn't it, that based on that theory that it was somebody before, they would have to have done it without oxygen at over 29,000 feet, which is almost, you would have said, almost impossible. So, but these two paved the way to follow, but the hazards, of course, as I mentioned before, are immense. Extreme weather, of course, avalanches, hypoxia, possible other health problems, it goes on. And basically people who have some experience but not enough experience to do the mountaineering training or to do the whole thing. You know, they've been inspired by these two to get there first, but then it boils down to preparation. And even then it can go sour. So I mentioned earlier at least 322 people have lost their lives on Mount Everest to date. And some of these bodies remain on the mountain. Now, I mentioned climbing the mountain unaided with oxygen. Well, to many listening here, including myself, when I'm looking at this, Everest has been climbed without the use of oxygen. I believe of the 6,664 people who've reached the summit of Everest, 188 have done so without the aid of oxygen, which is a remarkable achievement, or utter madness, depending on how you look at it. 15 of those died on the way down, and some of the others really struggled to make it back. Now, those figures at the end of 2023, I haven't cross-checked them, so the figure may be slightly different. It was a general consensus right up until the 1970s that it was thought utter madness to go to the summit without oxygen, until the first two men to achieve this were Reinhold Messner on the 8th of May 1978 together with Peter Habela. Until this point, experts believed it was near on impossible. Unless perhaps it had been done in past years by some Sherpa, unrecorded, as I've mentioned earlier. Now, when you're on the summit, an average human take in as little as 30% of oxygen in the air. Messner and Habela made it and safely returned. As if that wasn't enough, Messner was back at Everest with the intention of climbing to the summit totally solo, without oxygen, assisted tanks. On the 20th of August 1980, he made it. Not only that, it was classic Alpen style climb. No other climbers, no Sherpa support, nothing. Absolute madness to me anyway. No one to assist him whatsoever, no contingency plan if anything went wrong. Totally alone. Massive achievement, of course. He carried everything himself. The strategy was that he arrived 4 weeks before to acclimatise to and then get used to the route and everything. And then he left certain equipment when he and then dropped everything when he decided to go for the summit. The way he decided was on crossing the East Runbuck Glacier on the North Col and then onto the North Ridge. He actually spent one night at 26,902 feet on his own and made it to the summit the next day. An absolutely incredible feat and possible madness. I think there's an element of that in it, I have to say. Some would say that, but on the other hand, a brilliant, brilliant feat. But I can see how some would see it as the ultimate challenge. Such is the human condition. Incidentally, after ascending Everest solo without oxygen tanks assist, Reinhold went on to become the first person to climb all the world's 14 peaks over 26,200 feet and a load of other amazing record achievements. You have to be extremely fit endurance-wise, very, very fit indeed, but it's also very much due to your genetic makeup. You know, albeit if you're very, very fit and kind of a wiry individual with that sort of kind of linear muscles and everything, many people of that makeup have failed. Of course, outside of being blessed with the unique genetics, when you think of the typical climber, the wiry, sinewy character, compared to humans packed with much bigger, heavier muscle and being really strong. Which obviously then, you know, that type of character needs an awful lot more oxygen because the oxygen has to be distributed into the muscles. So there's a lot of factors there, but genetic makeup is natural genetic makeup is huge. Reinhold, believe it or not, holds 9 Guinness Book of Records. Whether madness or otherwise, Reinhold Messner is a very remarkable man with some incredible achievements. I think I should also mention he's an Italian, and another fact is that he's written over 80 books. That in itself is probably almost genius, isn't it? He's written 80 books. Peter Hebler is an Austrian. He was slightly older, a couple of years older. But there's one thing for me that is very notable. These Austrian-Italian mountaineers. And you look at the photos I've seen, remarkable, and they're much older, but they look younger for their years. Such as that's the alpine climate, isn't it? You often find that they seem to fare very well when they grow older. Well, outward appearance anyway. All right, as I pause for breath and regulate the old breathing a sec, I'd like to relate to you, the listener, some of my own experiences of altitude, albeit very, very limited, not in any way, shape or form like Everest, no way. Anyway, way back in the day when I was a very young man, I was working on operations. That's military operations. I don't normally talk about this because I've been a professional musician most of my life. As a very young man, I was on military operations and I was working with Gurkhas and I was in the Far East at altitude. And I'd been up there for about 2 or 3 weeks. I always sort of shy away from talking about military service because the problem is people pigeonhole you. And of course, we all start coming from different backgrounds. We all leave, and there's a million reasons why you do things and why you don't. But anyway, I thought I'd mention it here because I think it's interesting. I was part of Forward Recce, and I'm up there on the side of a mountain, dug in. And as you mean, nothing like Everest, of course. Nothing remotely like Everest. But we were at altitude. And the haze was clear in about, I don't know, 0600, 0630 hours. And I looked across about 7 to 10 k's away across another mountain, and what looked like lots of ants going up the side of this mountain. Very odd, with an odd range of motion. And if you ever experienced observation, we become experts at it actually, if it's sort of 7 to 10 k's away. For example, if you see sheep grazing in a field at 7 to 10k, with the naked eye, it doesn't look like there's any movement there at all. Not unless you pick up a set of binoculars. Well, in this case, we got the scopes and to check it out. I was with a couple other guys, and to see what we could make of it. And what we were looking at was a load of Gurkhas absolutely jogging up this mountain path. There were loads of them, and it wasn't just for a few seconds, it was for a long time because we observed it. We're at altitude and these guys are in full kit. They're not stripped down to battle assault or anything like that. No, they've got the packs on. You can see the spade on the back of the pack. They're carrying their Armalite or whichever weapon they were using. I think Armalites we were using out there. Okay, they've got weapons, no berries, helmets, the lot. And they are tabbing up this mountainside. And that, I have to say, was very, very impressive. 10 Gurkha, fantastic unit, fantastic tradition. I've worked with them, incredible. I got some incredible stories, but maybe, you know, back in the day I worked with them in World War II. My father worked with them. They are terrific, terrific. That's not for now, but they're incredible people. So that was my observation of people like that working at altitude. And add to that, you've got to put it in context when we're on this style of operations. You know, we're on 2 or 3 hours sleep a night for, say, 2 or 3 weeks, you know. And you have to be fit, of course, but anybody that's served will know what it's like, that you get used to that sleep deprivation and you just get used to it. But so you've got to put those things into context, and then you see the Gurkhas at work there. Terrific. And of course, once you've been up at altitude like that, I come down after, say, several weeks up there, and your endurance is incredible when you're back down to a lower level. And it always makes sense. It's wrong, really, but, you know, athletes at the Olympics, guys who've had the money behind them and been able to train at altitude, particularly the distance runners, you know, gives them a huge advantage, doesn't it, when they go to the Olympic Games and things like that. And I've never been a fan of the Olympics in that way, of just one person being better than that in an individualistic. I've never been a fan of it, really, because there's so many parameters involved with being the first or whatever. Anyway, that's just a side note. I continue. First and foremost, I think Everest is a beautiful thing to look at. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? And I don't want to portray climbers in a negative way because, you know, of the fantastic appeal climbers have for climbing. I mean, with all climbing, even elementary stuff, there has to be, there is an element of risk, but it's minimising the risk the best you can, isn't it? And I can see from the professional climber's point of view, you know, they perhaps want to notch up another thing on their bucket list. I can see that, and the different sort of herding instincts of people flocking to Everest to sort of tick it off as one of the things they have to do. The only thing I don't get is the oxygen thing. In one sense, fantastic achievement, as I've just mentioned, to do it without oxygen. But to make sense of the madness, perhaps, surely you should have tanks as an emergency. I don't necessarily think that you're proving anything to anybody. You can do it in a controlled environment to see how long you can do without oxygen. I don't necessarily think it is a great thing that it was done in one sense, but my own personal view is that there's no need to take that risk. I think that all climbers should have people close by with tanks to minimise the risk. It just makes sense, and I don't think that it's a feat to do it without. I've done a podcast on Apollo 11. You should go back and check that one. And it would be simply madness to think, I mean, and I go heavily into the radiation on the moon and all the other stuff, but, you know, to take off your helmet, perhaps, on the moon, you know, as an astronaut, see how long you could last. And I think if you go back and listen to that podcast, I think, you know, it's going to be less than 30 seconds, you know. And are astronauts going to undo their pressure suit just to see how long they can do, when we know it's absolutely madness to do it and there's a huge, huge risk? I really don't see the point in that. I think looking from a psychological perspective in the arts, for example, get loads of people saying, oh, we love this, we do this, and they don't really, because the proof's in their output. For example, an abstract painter, to me, that's someone that does this and explores The idea, 7 days a week, all the year round. They churn a body of work out and push forward with ideas, and they're prolific. They don't knock up a couple of paintings, say, every 16th or 20th week, something like that. No, it's constant. If you believe in yourself and you're committed, just the same way in modern jazz or seasoned blues artists, and particularly in modern jazz, you got to be committed. And you're committed, you got to be committed, and as soon as someone plays, you can tell if they're committed or not. So any climbers listening to this, climbing isn't really for me, but I get it. I get why you do it. All right, so I'm not anti-climbing. You know, it's a fantastic sport, and I get why you guys do it. And the world needs people like you, like it needs people of every type of character. Mountaineers have to have the ability to focus and pay attention, very close attention to detail, and often as not, for long, long periods of time. And at the same time, are in situations of physical and psychological stress. Now, if you check back to my D.B. Cooper podcast, I did number 12 was the first one, 17 was a really good follow-up to that. You should listen, and then there's a third one as well. But anyway, the D.B. Cooper podcast, the second one, I think it was number 17. You should listen to 12 first. We touched on certain psychology. And we did some of this in the harmonica ones, particularly pod 10 in psychologically of playing and stuff, where we discussed being in the zone, out of body experiences and all that kind of thing that some of us can get ourselves into. Well, in this case, the climber has attention to themselves, a transcendence associated with self forgetfulness and openness to transpersonal experience. In other words, in the zone. On other pods I've discussed this at length, often crave for it as a jazz saxophonist on a gig. When I used to be a jazz saxophonist, you crave for it because you don't necessarily get it all on every gig. You don't. But when in my case I used to get out of body experience, and some nights I could be on a gig and have it all night. It's rare, but when it happens, it's fantastic if everything sits right. And it happens for different people in different ways. But, you know, for the climber, I know I get this, once they're into that zone, then everything is focused at that point. You know, it's they're not actually thinking of the peak. They're not actually thinking of getting to the top. They're concentrating on doing the best job they can in that moment. And everything else is gone. A lot of pilots get it when they're flying. Fishermen can get it when they're, you know, looking over at the fishing rod. All different sort of things, and I've talked about this before. Mountains that are not far behind Everest, K2, standing at, I haven't done these in metres, have I? But I've got it here, 8,611 metres. That's 28,251.31 feet. But of course, things move, don't we? We've learned that now. Mount Everest is, and I've got down 29,035 feet here. There you go, 3 feet difference. So we've talked about these margins already, so we understand why. The highest point on Earth. Now, K2 is situated in the Karakoram Range, partly Chinese administrated enclave of the Kashmir region, autonomous region of, where are we? And the partly in the Bashtan portion of Kashmir. Sorry, I'm getting muddled up with what I'm saying here. And with the administration of Pakistan. So, okay, so we've got the Chinese and the Pakistan regions here involved with this. Interesting looking at these two mountains, although K2 is 800 feet shorter, there is a general feeling that among the top mountaineers, from what I've been reading and did my research on, that K2 is a more deadly mountain. Now, that seems odd to me initially, until I think it through. Some factors for this though. On K2, mountaineers face a constant 45 degree angle climbs no matter which route they take. They decide to take. And I just had a quick look and it says there's 91 deaths on K2. Well, that's not in comparison to Everest at 330, is it? But and it was first conquered in 1954. But of course, it's the type of climb. And I'm assuming that, I'm sure climbers have put me wrong here, but I'm assuming that some of the climbs are extremely, probably the most challenging. Although all climbs are challenging, aren't they? But I would guess the weather and all the rest of it, still the same sort of factors, but that's what I've read from some of the mountaineers. I mean, I'm sure they're both equally as difficult and challenging no matter what, but that's how they see it for some climbers. So, why do the climbers do it? Well, I've already touched on this. There's many reasons why they do it, and I've talked about this. All human beings are complex in our reasoning and what we do. However, you know, there is the bucket list. That's one of the reasons why they do it. There's to get themselves and escape everything. I've talked about being in the zone where you could leave everything behind, put yourself in a different place. There's the elation of getting to the peak that can give a euphoria. They can get it for that, can't they? And the journey just itself. My own experience in music and the arts is I know that the most successful people I've ever come across to educate, the ones that enjoy the journey are the most successful, irrespective of their abilities at outset. Simply because if they like what they're doing in the journey, they'll end up doing it more than anybody else, but they won't tell anybody they're doing that amount. They just do it because they love to do it. And as I said earlier, so they get extremely proficient because they get there by default. They just do it a lot. And some people have even more natural ability. Others perhaps don't have to do it as much, but there will be a point in time where they shove everything, including the kitchen sink, into it over a number of years, no matter who they are. And that's from my experience. Oh, and the ones that are enjoying the journey, well, they're the ones that have the world and every single thing that is in it. To quote a line from Kipling, no less. Having said all that, the danger is danger, I guess. No matter how you take care, and Everest is a very dangerous place, whether it's extreme weather or not, and you need an element of luck. And experience tells you the more experience, surely the better chance of success. But all climbers do need an element of luck for sure. So, you know, climbers are to be admired. It's a dangerous sport, but it can be so, so rewarding, both mentally and physically. Back to the mountain itself, Mount Everest. Well, here's a thought to take from this podcast. While there is the challenge of the climb in Everest, it has some 35,000 visitors every single year. That's an enormous amount. I'm reading that correct. Some are already suggesting it's becoming swamped and overcrowded with tourists compared to other places. While on the plus side, it's a boost to the local economy for sure, isn't it? The Sherpas are allowed to be tour guides, etc. And some of them, it's creating prosperity for them in some quarters. But there's a devastating downside. 13% of the lands of Nepal have been given protection status due to far too many tourists each year. The Sagarmatha National Park, remember that name from earlier, deemed to be directed and affected by pollution. Huge problems. Forests cut down for fuel, for fire and all the rest of it. Attempting to keep Everest base camp and the trek clean. Attempting to preserve that for the next generation. But here's the thing. There's human waste left by climbers on Mount Everest. So, there's a dead body management they've got to deal with. That's a constant problem. There's waste left by the climbers. Litter, garbage, everything. And, of course, human waste. Sanitation. The slopes have discarded oxygen canisters, abandoned tents, food containers. And yes, I have to say it, unfortunately, human feces. At base camp, toilets exist, albeit tented, and they're basically large barrels that, well, they hope, get collected and emptied at some point. But that's it, as far as the toilets go. And as far as the mountains are concerned, well, they have to relieve themselves on site kind of thing. There are no actual figures how much waste is on the mountain, but from the research I've done and have a look at several sources, it's tons of it, absolute tons of it. Now you've got glaciers where litter is now spilling out. Camps are overflowing with human waste. And remember, there's climate change causing the ice and the snow to melt, exposing even more rubbish that then it's been covered over for, what, 20, 30, 40 years and more. And now that's spilling over and coming down the mountainside. The environment's getting wrecked. And it doesn't take much imagination to tell you that there's a huge danger to health. Everyone living in the region, by the region meaning the land, the direct rainfall, and the snow melts from the mountains and the streams, and it all comes down. Now, get this: there's no waste management or sanitation facilities in the area whatsoever. They simply put raw sewage and the rubbish into large pits. So you can imagine, just outside the local villages, where they need to wash, and the waterways are, you know, think about during the monsoon season. Obviously, water's polluted by fecal matter, causes danger, waterborne diseases such as cholera and hepatitis A. It's not pleasant, is it? Not pleasant listening, but I kind of had to say it. The climbers doing the climb, yep. The passion and everything, I really get it. I get that. However, surely mankind's better than this. Surely we can invent some sort of physical and mental challenges of similar back home, you know, to cover these sort of challenges, that we don't have to go out and wreck the place like this. Surely we have the technology, at least consider it. I know it sounds bizarre, but, you know, together with climate change and all the rest of it, we're absolutely crippling the place with pollution. You know, we're in the 21st century. Surely the human being as a species are better than this, and we can come up with a clean solution. And at the present moment, it's kind of a mindless trek to utter destruction, isn't it? And basically, you know, the top and bottom of it is we're absolutely wrecking the planet. It's going to be eventually on the path of no return if we keep on doing what we're doing. So we really have to knuckle down and do something, I hope. I mean, just imagine it, if you're an alien from outer space, far, far advanced than us, that they're sort of looking down on our planet Earth, and they're watching these 35,000 people trekking over to Mount Everest and absolutely wrecking the place and coming away from it and all the rest of it, and just watching the planet as a whole. That's just one aspect of it. They would think we're absolutely mad, wouldn't they? I mean, you know, as an outsider looking in, it just seems absolutely crazy. That's aside of all the infighting and war that we do. This is apart from that, and the climate change and everything else, you know. But it does seem, and the word, I use this a lot actually, and the word is ludicrous. I mentioned hope. Quote, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. Andy Dufresne, Shawshank Redemption. Okay, that's me. I'm out for today. Don't forget to check back and look through all the other podcasts. Look at my Harpo the Healer YouTube and subscribe to that. I'll take it out with some blues. I'll catch you on the rebound.